episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul David.
And I'm your other co-host, Maya Doran-Pahombe.
Today we're speaking with Kat James, who's the Director of New Projects at Consultant Connect. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to tackle how telemedicine can cut down NHS waiting times. And I know for our UK listeners, that's a massive topic of concern. It's a topic of concern for folks across the country. Have heard some absolute horror stories about folks having to wait quite a while for loved ones and for themselves. So it's a critical issue. By way of introduction, as I said before, Kat is the Director of New Projects at Consultant Connect. Consultant Connect is a telemedicine provider for the NHS, which covers over 42 million patients across the UK.
Essentially, Consultant Connect connects community-based NHS clinicians with hospital doctors for advice and treatment plans. Instead of defaulting to referring a patient to a hospital, Consultant Connect enables a GP, paramedic, or nurse to get immediate advice via telephone or messaging from a specialist. In 2023, it helped 400,000 patients avoid unnecessary hospital trips. At a time where over 7.6 million people are on waiting lists, this is vital for helping to tackle the healthcare crisis.
And for the background, Kat started her career in consultancy in France before moving to marketing and sales, a topic that's near and dear to our hearts across Europe, and has worked at Consultant Connect for the last 5 years. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
So let's jump right in. We'd love you to just tell us a bit more about how a tool like Consultant Connect can really impact NHS patients and staff.
Sure. Well, Maya's touched on it, but let me tell you a bit more about it, how it works. So it's actually been around for coming up to 9 years. And this was obviously, well, pre the pandemic. Already there was a tool in place for the NHS where when a doctor was at the end of their remit of what they knew they could do with that patient in general practice, they could write a written request that would go then to a hospital doctor to reply. Normally that would take 48 hours or more. In many places, we knew that it could take days, sometimes week, if there wasn't the hospital capacity of people responding to those requests. So the idea when we first launched was to offer a telephone-based alternative. So picking up the phone or an app, and within under 30 seconds, you're through to a specialist to get advice on how to start a treatment for that patient without having to refer them to hospital. So let's take the case of you have a neurology issue, you've been back several times to your GP tries different things from medications to lifestyle changes and nothing works. And when they get to the end of that rope, basically their next available option is to actually refer you onto your neurology list. But imagine instead of putting you onto a neurology list where you're at current NHS waiting times in neurology, which is one of the most pressured specialties, you'll probably be waiting for over a year to see a doctor. So your problems will continue during that time, probably get worse. Your mental health will get worse. It might impact your ability to go to work and so on and so forth. But imagine your doctor got through to a neurologist within under 30 seconds. So then the neurologist can review the patient case based on the information that the GP gives and start treatment immediately. And often, and what we see from our data, for two-thirds of patients, that results in enough input there and then for the patient no longer having to go to a hospital later on. And for all other patients, it means they can start a treatment. And then when they eventually do need to still go to hospital, they come on a more informed basis. So they will have already tried A, B, or C. So that was elective care, but eventually we also ventured into urgent care. So nowadays we have paramedics using the system when they're on scene, specifically with, let's say, an elderly patient where they know what's involved for an elderly patient when they go into hospital. Often it's tricky to get them out of hospital because of care plans needing in place and so on. Or they deteriorate in hospital simply because of the environment that they're in. So that criticality provides massive opportunity for a paramedic to speak to, let's say, an emergency medicine consultant or a frailty consultant immediately and get enough input for that patient to either stay at home or find a more appropriate setting. And again, in urgent care, what we see is around about one third of patients going through that service end up not in a hospital setting at all, so i.e. stay on scene. And another third is directed to a more appropriate place than the emergency department. That's basically what it was invented for and what predominantly we still cover most today, but then we have ventured into other things around messaging, teledermatology. What we often hear from GPs also is to say, the pure fact of the reassurance for, like, let's say that worried patient about their child and saying, yes, you are a GP, but I really would like to see a consultant. And then realizing a consultant's at the other end of the phone can often provide reassurance rather than actually new treatment plans. But then it can also be the other way around. So one of our cardiologists is down the road from us and often pops into our office for coffee, and we ask him, what is your latest story? And the one that's always stuck in my head is this one where he said the GP rang with an ECG result, a cardiogram in front of them, thinking that it wasn't actually much to worry about, but he was just wondering which pathway to send that patient down. And the cardiologist said, well, I advise you ring an ambulance now. And the patient got in an ambulance and actually had a heart attack in the ambulance. So the GP had not picked up on something unusual that the cardiologist spotted. I mean, these are, thank goodness, very rare cases and don't happen very much. But I just wanted to show you that it can also be the other way around, where someone thought it wasn't urgent and then ended up getting that urgent input that they needed to actually save lives. So the system save lives, as well as sending patients down the correct pathway and providing that reassurance that I've just mentioned.
How have you sort of developed mechanisms to collect those sorts of stories other than your sort of coffees with cardiologists on a Tuesday?
Yeah, so obviously, on the one hand, we capture the data all the time. So after every interaction, we collect the data on what happens with the patient next, so that every project understands what impact it's having in their area. But then also, what we're quite keen on is we work with a large account management team that has that regular interaction with our users. So they reach out to them to say what's working well, what's been a recent case study. So we ask them for their inputs, and that's where we get these nuggets. And what they then also do is they help us to inform other areas, because most of my job in new projects is to go around the country and speak to new stakeholders in the NHS and actually do a knowledge transfer. So I will then say, recently this happened in so-and-so area, and then I can inform other areas of what they've seen and how that's transferable. So I think that's also a really important piece, that we are kind of that knowledge sharing enabler.
And in terms of sort of meeting with stakeholders and introducing them to Consultant Connect, since COVID-19, I'm sure you're very familiar with the sort of increasing fatigue with tech rollouts in the NHS. Consultants and trusts are skeptical about integrating technology due to lengthy onboarding processes, likelihood of technical difficulties, which could interrupt clinical practice, and due to more general tech skepticism. How are you ensuring that Consultant Connect is a tool that clinicians actually want to learn how to use?
Yeah, I completely sympathize with that. I mean, obviously, the pandemic has brought on a huge influx of new tools. So being a clinician these days, not only being clinical, but then learning new tools, I have absolutely massive sympathy. Our mantra has always been no training required. So luckily, we're obviously operating in a space which is communication, which is something that comes natural. And we've always said, if our platform was at a point where people needed to read a manual, then we've done something wrong. So we don't actually have user manuals as such, and there's no training required. So we've always developed the app with that mantra of it needs to be intuitive enough for someone to learn on their first case. And I think that's the thing. So try and keep it simple is one thing. The other thing is review it with clinicians and be guided by clinicians, because what I often find in my role is I'm managing a large cohort of different stakeholders, and commissioners think the project needs something. A service manager think a project needs something else. And then the clinicians think this, but then there's also responding clinician at the other end. So make sure that it's your users, you have your have that voice in your product development and in the rollouts. And then really, but even a step back, if you think about going with a product or with a project in the first place, is you actually need to solve a problem that's big enough for clinicians. And I think in our case, the problem of clinicians not having an alternative to get hold of a specialist. So the alternative is that what I described, 48 hours or days or weeks to get a response, or when on the phone using the switchboard and not getting through, giving up because you've run out of time to wait for someone to call back on a bleep. And that problem was big enough for people to actually wanting to try something different. And I think that's also important. What I've noticed with seeing tech rolls out post-pandemic is clinicians are being asked a lot, as in taking on new things. And sometimes they question then, is that tool useful enough to make my job better? And if you can't answer that question for them, then they will be unlikely to engage. The other thing I found when rolling out new projects, which has been fascinating, is if you didn't solve that big problem, but also if you find your champion. Like, I had this case where it was even 2 days before the rollout started, and I was on the phone to this GP who was going to be the lead champion for this. And he said, don't you worry, in our area, this is all straightforward. People just follow. And I was like, okay, tell me more. He says, you wait and see. I'll post it on WhatsApp last night. You check the sign-up numbers tomorrow. And he was absolutely right. So he managed to get 120 people signed up to the system before we'd even started the official rollout, simply because he was someone they trusted, and he was kind of the front runner. And I think it's really important for technologies to find their champions that then go and bring others along. So I cannot stress that enough, how important it is to have these champions that not only then bring others along, but also give you feedback. And you need to be willing to be quite critical then with yourself, right? If they say to you, this needs to be adjusted, then take that on board and go with it. So I think that's a super important aspect too.
I want to talk to you about, you know, business operations. As we know, the NHS has a big, complex organization, and maybe unlike other businesses, you know, the parts of it are very different depending on what aspect that you're in. So, for example, the systems that the Blackpool Trust, you know, will look very different from those in the Central and Northwest London. So amidst all that variation, how do you roll out technology across the board, you know, with fidelity and making sure that it's, you know, taken up well?
Well, so that's an interesting one. Pretty much most calls I come to, people would open up or say somewhere along in the conversation, we are the worst in the country for doing X, Y, Z. Everyone thinks they are the worst. Everyone thinks they're very different from everyone else. But Paul, I would actually challenge you on that one and say the NHS has more similarities and commonalities than things being different. Of course, I'm not trying to play down that demographics and different levels of deprivation and so on and so forth. So, and no doubt about that, a local NHS system is designed to take care of that and to make sure their services fit that population. So I'm not playing that down. But in terms of simple initiative like ours, a communication initiative, it isn't that different from the north to the south, from, you know, from Wales to Scotland to England. We operate across all three nations, and they actually have a lot of commonalities, even though at the face of it, we might think not to. So I think it's finding the commonalities and starting off with the common ground, starting off with the most simple use cases, some that I described already today, in ECG sharing. So sharing an ECG from a GP to a consultant is the same if you do it in Liverpool that it is if you do it in Cornwall. So start with a simple pathway, and then as you go along, understand your project, understand the area, understand the levels of deprivation and what is needed, and then adjust those pathways as you go along. That's kind of my recommendations. Get started, because often what you find also with NHS tech rollouts is you're obviously managing a large amount of stakeholders, so it can take you a long time until you get going. But aim for small, aim for simple, and then scale up fast. I think that's what we've seen works best, and that's what I truly recommend.
Yeah, and could you talk a bit more about your sort of rollout in Wales and the success of that and why you think that did go so smoothly and how that story has become such a sort of linchpin for Consultant Connect's efficiency?
Yeah, that's a good one. We had actually been talking to the various health boards in Wales long time before the pandemic, and sadly, it was the pandemic that brought it all on in a very short period of time. And it was very much driven by central teams, supported by the central Welsh NHS and government to bring it on quickly. So the first health board put their hand up and was pretty much ready to go for us to set up and actually press the button within 72 hours. And I think that set such a precedent that other health boards felt like they needed to move at pace as well. And it was the pandemic, and basically the reality was there was no alternative to doing this, i.e., as you all know, services for elective care shut down. a lot of clinicians were repurposed to help with the pandemic and so on. So for a GP that had an urgent situation with a patient in primary care, but not urgent enough to actually require A&E attendance in hospital, their only alternative to actually be in touch with a specialist was via the phone or via our contact. So uptake came naturally because everything else was shut down. But the learning there is certainly the investment into central project groups and kind of that empowerment then from the central teams into local health, but to say, get on with it for the best of your population and move at pace. And it's a phenomenal story, really. It's still very strong. And it ventured quite early, quite quickly into the ambulance side of things. So today, the Welsh Ambulance Service is probably one of our biggest user group ever. So they place something like over 5,000 calls a month alone just from ambulance users into local hospital services to try and keep patients at home wherever possible because they're receiving enough input, or navigating to the patient to the right place first time. So wherever possible, avoiding a trip to A&E for someone that doesn't need to be in A&E.
And in terms of sort of identifying the specialists who are going to be on the other side of the phone, giving that advice or giving those instructions, I should say, how could you explain to me how that works and what it looks like for the specialist involved? Are they kind of sat at home like they would be during an on-call shift or...
Yes, absolutely. Well, you've actually touched there on the hardest part of our initiative, which is the responding clinicians, because it's much easier to convince the user to pick it up, like the GP, the paramedic, the nurse in the community. For them, they're the requirer, so they find it easy to navigate to the system. For the responding end, it's always been the hardest part, and I'll explain a bit about how things evolved over time. So when we first launched, it was with local hospital teams only, and the idea was that you go to the team and say, try out the system, see if it's for you. No obligation to take part. So be on the rotor. When a call comes through, try and take that call. If you can't take the call, let it go and it'll go to the next person on the rotor. And through that, kind of through that voluntary approach, you're almost like taking away the pressure of you have to do it. And then what we've found is people come forward naturally. Some people, some clinicians, some consultants are more pro speaking on the phone and open to it, and others are a bit more hesitant. And some will do it whilst on their admin time, whilst walking in between places in the hospital. And I even know of consultants who say, well, hang on a minute, I actually stop a consultation to pick up a phone call from a GP because I know that's my next patient further down the line that might not come in, that didn't need to be here. So some are going a step further. It's very much a personal preference, and you often find that in a team of, let's say, 10 consultants being available on a day, half of them will be up for this, the other half won't participate. And that's good enough to run reliable enough rotors, really. So it's that voluntary approach has worked quite well for us. Having said that, to deliver a reliable service, we usually say the golden standard is you want like 80+% first-time answer rate. And why is that? What does that mean? If you kind of deliver that level of reliability, then you know that your users got confidence in the service and therefore will regularly come back. If we start to drop below 80-70%, we have an issue and we need to fix it. And therefore, a couple of years into the service, we pivoted slightly and decided we actually ran our own network as well. So outside of the local hospitals that we work with, we have a national team that can be the backup solution. So whenever the service has looped through the local rotors already and no one is able to take a call in the local service, then it loops to our national network as a backup, which is kind of the second best option because you want a local GP to speak to a local consultant, ideally. But then there's also that view that some advice is better than none. And obviously they're all trained in their specialty and therefore can give advice, again, coming back to my ECG example, on an ECG as well as that person in the local service. What they, however, can't do is do local signposting. And in that case, we would probably encourage the user to try again a few minutes later and see if a local consultant has become free. So yeah, it's very much down to finding those people that are pro being on the service. And then it's that word of mouth again that then spreads, right? So it's if that consultant then goes to another consultant at their weekly clinical meeting and says, oh, I've actually given this service a go. It's not as bad as we thought it is. It's not like the telephones ring all day. Then actually word spreads and users come forward and actually want to take part. And they often also talk about that that reward feeling, like you have spoken to a GP where you've helped the patient, not having to come to hospital unnecessarily. And also that sort of educational side of things, you've upskilled someone potentially who, once they've got that presentation again, a few months, few weeks down the line, they will no longer ask the same question because they now know the answer to it. So it's multifaceted from that perspective.
Just moving on to evidence showing that women are underserved in the NHS, we have a Saving Lives, Improving Mothers Care report that finds that systemic biases prevent women with complex and multiple problems receiving the care that they need. I would love if you could explain how Consultant Connect aimed to narrow this healthcare gap.
Yes, I think it's very timely. I think it's only been quite recently in the press that latest figures have been published, and it showed that there are currently 750,000 women on a waiting list waiting for their first outpatient appointment in a hospital setting, which is obviously a huge number and also three times as much as it was pre-pandemic. So massively, massively challenged service. So I think the way I would come to this first is to say, hospitals, so an acute setting, is the right place for the patients that need that level of care. And on that 750,000 patients waiting, there will be a lot of women that need hospital-based care. And the idea is really through services like ourselves, through telemedicine pathways, so through alternative pathways, to free up that space in acute care for those that really need it. But for other patients, there might be other solutions. So in gynecology, for instance, we support local hospitals that are on that list of hospitals with are particularly challenged to actually deliver review of those referrals to identify patients with that can go into an alternative. So they either go into what the NHS calls a tier two service, which is a community-based service, or they can receive a management plan virtually, i.e. the consultants from our network write up a plan that actually says, dear patient, I've reviewed your medical history, I've reviewed your recent test results, and I recommend you start with treatment A. If A doesn't work, we go to treatment B, and there's also alternative C. So they write up a plan that can start immediately. And for the majority of those patients, that will be enough care for them actually to manage their symptoms there and then. And for those patients that still need to come to hospital later on, they've already tried A, B, and C, and therefore then when they turn up in hospital, they can go straight to, in that case, D, right? So it's about a hybrid model of acute care for those that really need it, community and virtual care for patients where it's better suited. What we often see in that service as a kind of tangible example is a lot of women are on hospital waiting lists for menopause-related symptoms. And menopause-related symptoms is a good example of where it's much better to be cared for in the community setting by clinicians who are closer to home. And equally, there's a lot that can be done with virtual management plans, which doesn't require a face-to-face appointment. And obviously, face-to-face appointments come with a lot of requirements from the patients as well. It's taking that time off work for women, often involves childcare and so on and so forth. So all that can be done much more efficient for the patient, but more importantly, I think, faster, i.e. rather than being that year on a waiting list to be seen in acute, you get your treatment plan to start there and then. So there are alternatives. And I think if those were deployed at scale, we would see that 750,000 patients waiting come down by massive levels. So our data from project that we've been running in that space shows that between 30 and 40% of patients can usually receive an immediate management plan that can implement it there and then. And then also, depending on what's locally available, 20 to 30% of patients can go to a community service if one is available. So women's hubs are around, but my argument would be much more is required to deliver them at scale. And that's what's the big hope, is that the next NHS 10-year plan will see an expansion of those women's hubs coming forward. And that will help massively with bringing those waiting lists down for women.
Completely. Thank you. I mean, that's exciting. But I also hope the health secretary is listening and taking notes. To round off the discussion now, I'd just like to ask you a couple of quick fire questions.
Sure.
So first off, Kat, if you could found another tech startup, what would it be and why?
It's a good one. I probably haven't found it because if I had, then I wouldn't be on the podcast today. I would probably be busying the company. But I would say certainly in health tech, because I do think it's such a rewarding thing to wake up in the morning and knowing that you're improving patients' life, obviously by not, like myself, being non-clinical, but in the background helping to helping for clinicians to have better alternatives to what they sometimes have today. So health tech would certainly be one I'm interested in. I'm also a kind of green transport and climate change geek in that sense. So that might be an alternative. But I've really, since being with Consultant Connect, my passion for healthcare has only grown. So it's more likely to be in the tech space.
Cool. And thinking more broadly, what tech invention makes you the most excited currently?
Yeah, I think I've touched already today on underserved areas. I think that's such a huge topic. And I think there's still so much to be done. I think we are, if you think about it, although we obviously all maybe complain about the NHS at times, and we've all heard of stories of patients who've not received the care that we would hope to. But in other countries, the situation can be much more severe of having access to care. So, for instance, one of our charitable projects that as Consultant Connect we run is we run a teledermatology initiative with the Burma Skincare Initiative, which actually gives patients in Myanmar access to UK dermatologist specialists for their skin conditions. And that's because in the country, obviously, skin conditions is a huge subject. The country is obviously under huge pressure from the war. And I think the number is that for the 55 million patients that they cover, they only have 100 dermatologists in the country, so they cannot cover the demand. And our initiative helps them with getting access to UK dermatologists who volunteer to deliver that care remotely. So photos can be shared between in-country clinicians and the UK dermatologists to speed up care for those patients. Another example is one of our sister companies, and we're part of a group called Teladoc Health. One of our sister companies in Canada delivers a remote emergency medicine room for patients in the Canadian provinces who haven't got access to that level of care on the ground. So I think those kind of remote telemedicine models is what really motivates me to bring better outcome for patients.
That's fascinating. And yeah, not to hijack the sort of the quickfire questions a bit with another questions about your work, but do you have other of those sort of remote services, or are you planning to develop more?
It's definitely on our radar. I mean, we have been looking to bring the Canadian model over here. I think there is obviously as much as a need, as therefore not as need driven, but we're, for instance, already running telephone services for the remote areas in Wales and Scotland. So in Scotland, for instance, we work with a health board called Tayside, and I remember the emergency medicine consultant saying the other day, the longest ambulance ride for someone in their health board is 2.5 hours, right? So if you're a paramedic on the ground with a patient and you need to decide, do you bring them in or not? It's a big decision because it's a 2.5 hour one-way trip for that patient. So there's definitely the potential to do more for remote areas. So I think watch the space is what I can say.
Exciting. Well, that doesn't very much lead me on to my next question. So it's just going to be an awkward gap. What tech innovation are you the most concerned about right now?
Concerned about. So I guess I'm sure you would have had other podcast guests probably on the subject alone of artificial intelligence. It's obviously one of the most talked topics, not only in healthcare, but in obviously in life, I suppose, at the moment. As much as I'm excited by the advancements that artificial intelligence can deliver, and obviously in the space of health tech massively, and the amount of trials going on is they are at scale, I'm equally concerned about the pace at which regulation keeps up with with those developments. I think that's the big thing in healthcare and outside. And I think the reason I say that and what I would compare that to is maybe social media. You know, social media has been around for many, many years, but also, again, a hot topic recently in the press is obviously the pressure now on those social media companies around how to protect specifically teenagers and vulnerable people and on those platforms. And I think there's a commonality here that things are developed with the good in mind and are to the benefit of society as a whole, but there are parts of it that need very stringent regulation. And I think that's where my concern around artificial intelligence is the pace of both is the pace of regulation going at the same pace as the developments are happening. So I think that is the one I'm definitely monitoring very closely.
Who's one literal human who has been integral to your career journey?
I'd probably like to call out two. So I was very lucky when I was in one of my first companies that I worked at, I was offered a one-to-one coaching opportunity with a lovely, lovely lady who I'm still meeting every few months now. And this is, we're going back to, oh gosh, showing my age, 2008. So I've known her since 2008, and she's always been the one that has encouraged me to go for things. I think when I was offered promotions, specifically when I was a lot younger, I would kind of have my doubts, like, am I ready for this? Should I really go for this? Am I the best suited candidate? And she would kind of spin it around and show me that I am ready, I have worked hard and I've developed those skills, and she would encourage me to go for it. And I probably needed that second push. So my husband has been very good, also helping me to kind of give myself that push that I needed at times where I wasn't quite ready to believe in that promotion that I was probably in hindsight often ready for. So yeah, those two have been very, very, very important in my career.
And finally, what's an inspirational quote that stuck with you throughout your journey in tech?
Yeah, I'd probably answer it from a more recent experience if I can alter your question slightly, because it's a quote that stuck with me so massively. So I was at the Oxford Business School Entrepreneurship Conference this month. And one of the keynote speakers was Greg Jackson, who is the founder of Octopus Energy and the technology platform Kraken. And he's also one of our original founders and has been our chairman for many, many years. And in that speech, he referred to the quote saying, "Be a rat, not a mouse." And what did he mean by that, especially in the context of tech? He basically said, when you as a new competitor, as a challenger in the market, walk into a room that is full of dominant incumbents, a mouse would run away. A mouse is sort of scared of people and runs away. But a rat kind of claims its place and say, well, I'm meant to be here. And he gave everyone in the room, and this was obviously MBAs, so young entrepreneurs, he gave the advice to say, have that confidence to stay in that room and challenge the existing competition and claim your place and just go for it. And I think it's such a great quote in the context of tech. So for us, it was very similar. When we started in 2015, there was already a tool for what we are doing, basically called advice and guidance. There was a written tool and people were querying, well, why does the NHS need another tool when there's already one there? And we said, well, we're an alternative, we're an additional challenge. And obviously now history shows in 9 years, we're processing over a million calls a year, that we have our place to be there next to the other rats, the system that's already there. So yeah, be a rat, not a mouse.
There are so many individuals in tech at the same time though, who I wish would be a bit more of a mouse than a rat, you know?
Cool. Well, I think it's a good place to end. Kat James, we're really appreciative of you being on the pod today. Where can folks learn more about the great work you're doing at Consulting Connect?
Yeah, absolutely. Reach out anytime. We're at consultconnect.org.uk. And yeah, thanks for having me today.
Of course. Thank you for jumping on. This has been another great episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. Thank you again to Kat James, Director of New Projects at Consulting Connect, for jumping on the pod. And as always, listeners, please, please give us a review. Give us a 5-star rating so we can keep getting more great guests like Kat onto the pod. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.